This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
The Informer is funded in part by the Community Broadcasting Foundation, cbf.com.au, and of course, the members and donors of Joy 94.9.
Welcome to The Informer Daily. I'm your host, Dean Curie.
When I was a kid, I was very much, you know, on the outside. You know, I wasn't part of the clique at school, you know, desperate to belong, you know, to the fashionable, you know, kids at school. And I think maybe that's part of it, these echoes from one's childhood.
As it's a long weekend, today on the show, we're going to look back at one of our past interviews as best-selling author Jasper Ford sits down with The Informer's executive producer, Arian Potts, as they discuss his speculative fiction, geek culture, Brexit, the Royals, and his career working in film.
I'm a bit of sci-fi. I'm kind of speculative. I'm fantasy. I'm kind of all over the place. But I kind of like to call it speculative fiction because I have I write by a concept that I call the narrative dare, where essentially is I think up a weird concept like, you know, Humpty Dumpty was murdered. You know, discuss or, you know, explain the porridge and the three bears, why it was at different temperatures when it was poured at the same time. Or write a story about somebody who can travel inside books, you know, a world order based on visual colour, or Early Riser, my latest one, write a thriller set in a world in which humans always hibernate.
Yes.
So I think it's a kind of speculative kind of fiction.
With Early Riser, you certainly went in a different direction than your first series, Thursday Next, but still in similar sort of themes, you know, similar geography and... I don't know how to put it. There's the voice that you have as a writer that, that certainly comes through. And I kind of see them as going together in a way because they're exploring these really unusual ideas, I don't know, in a similar way.
Yeah, and there's, I suppose they would be because it's me writing it. It's a very interesting question because I think when you're in any sort of creative endeavor, you're kind of exporting your worldview. You know, whether you're a photographer or an artist, you know, a musician, a writer, and you have this way that you look at the world. And even though the Thursday Next world, which is a world which is a sort of parallel world to ours, with where people love literature that much more. It's kind of a world that I kind of like, you know, but I can also see that world, although it'd be nice in a lot of ways, would still be flawed, you know, because humans are, you know, ultimately, you know, flawed. And I think that's the same with the Early Riser world. It's looking at this slightly off-kilter, different way of looking at things that still has very human flaws in it that you can pull the drama out of.
A lot of your characters come from the outside of their community. They just don't fit in with where they're at, and they're struggling to work within that world. What sort of drives that theme for you?
I think it's a sort of a trope that works quite well in storytelling. From a strict sort of narrative point of view, is to say, you know, the whole fish out of water. Someone slightly on the margins. Someone has to prove themselves. Someone who has to make mistakes. Someone who's forced into decisions that they perhaps don't want to make. And I think that slight reluctance, you know, adds a certain frisson to them. In a book I did called Shades of Grey, there's a character named Eddie Russet, and all he wants to be is like a sort of average. You know, he does not want to make waves at all and finds himself sort of pulled into this sort of, you know, broader sort of struggle for freedom. And I kind of like that idea. It's kind of Cary Grant in North by Northwest. You know, all of a sudden, he's like this ordinary guy who's like thrown into this extraordinary situation, and I think that's nice because a lot of for readers, it's exciting. It's this journey of discovery, but I think as readers and as humans, we're always slightly adrift. You know, because we've got this undiscovered country in front of us we can't see. You know, we're traveling through time, but we're traveling backwards. You know, we can see where we've been, but we can't see where we're going. And that's like really frustrating, you know, and if you were driving cars that way, it'd be, you know, very dangerous. So I think there's that sense of, you know, what happens next? You know, how is it going to get really bad? Is it, you know, what's going to happen? So I think from a narrative point of view, I like it. And also, you know, and I may appear as being a sort of and sound like a sort of really sort of confident person now. But when I was a kid, I was very much, you know, on the outside. You know, I wasn't part of the clique at school, you know. Desperate to belong, you know, to the fashionable, you know, kids at school. And I think maybe that's part of it, these echoes from one's childhood.
There certainly is sort of a huge influence from sort of geek culture, if I may. And is that something that a lot of your fans relate well to?
I think so. I mean, the thing I really like about, you know, fantasy, sci-fi, you know, those sort of genre readers is they have an immensely elastic imagination. And I love that. And that's why I think, you know, my readers are very special readers, or readers who really like this sort of fiction. I really, really like them because, like, anything goes, and they have this wonderful, expansive imagination and acceptance. And I think there's a sense of when you're you have that, you know, very expansive imagination. When you're brought up on fantasy and sci-fi, you have this wonderful inquiring mind. You know, there's nothing closed off to you. You know, you love stuff. And I think, you know, if there is the I'm not sure I like the geek word or, you know, nerd or anything like that, but I think it's you love stuff. People who love stuff, and I love stuff. You know, I love, you know, all different sort of things, whether it's technology or future tech, or it's, you know, Carmen Miranda in her fruit hat. You know, it's all these things. I just love it because it's all part of this, you know, amazing rich tapestry, you know, of existence, of human existence, which is, you know, I think celebratory all the time, no matter what it is.
Yeah, you know, geek is, I think, easy shorthand, but it sounds like you're saying that it's more about people who are supremely curious.
Yeah.
And interested in exploring
other things. Absolutely. And whose mind is not fixed. You know, that's the most wonderful thing about an inquiring mind, you know. And that you can sort of look at something somewhere and you can be brought up to have some views in some way. But if somebody says, hey, have you ever thought so-so? You go, wow, yeah, I never thought of that way. And then all of a sudden your mind has changed. You know, and that for me is, you know, one of the, you know, something major that we need to, you know, get into society. Is this fact that you can change your mind and you can be wrong about things, and it's okay to say, my mind has changed. I am totally now on board with this new way of thinking. And sadly, we don't seem to have that so much. Mm. We need more of it.
In your Thursday Next series, which was your first series of eight?
Seven at the moment. Yeah, there'll be an eighth, I think, because seven is it's an annoying number, isn't it? Seven books in a series.
Yeah, that's why I was.
Yeah, it's got to be eight.
Yeah,
it's a nice round number.
And your books also don't have a chapter 13, it seems.
No,
but you had a 13th book.
Yes, I did. I should have not had a 13th book, but I couldn't really do that. Maybe my 13th book isn't my 13th book. It's actually my 14th book that I haven't read my 13th book. Written my 13th book. So many people say, how many books have you written? I should actually say 15, not 14.
Yeah.
Good thought. I'm going to use that. Thank you.
Anytime. So without trying to project too much of my own worldview onto you, in the Thursday Next series, which I'm speaking about because it's the one that I've read the most of, I find your books really rich. I read quite a bit, and so I can generally read fairly quickly, but when I read your books, I have to slow down because there's so much richness of the language and there's so much wordplay that if you miss two sentences, it kind of starts to get challenging. So that richness is really lovely because it forces you to appreciate what you're reading and take that time and really explore the world being created.
Thank you.
But without projecting too much of my worldview, in the Thursday Next series, there is quite a bit of camp in some of the characters. For instance, Mrs. Havisham is completely camp, as are the Mrs. Danver clones, the Danver clones.
Yeah.
Is that part about being curious around the world or repurposing some of these figures? Because in Great Expectations, Mrs. Havisham is pretty campy.
I mean,
she's sitting around in her wedding dress for 40 years. That's
Although it's very interesting that she could actually be as young as like 27, 28, because it's 10 years since she was abandoned and she could have been married when she was 17.
Right, of course.
Because I think it's only the movies that actually give us this old lady thing. But anyway, but I think so. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's not intentional, but when you're writing, you're kind of regurgitating everything that's you've ever absorbed, you know, and certainly, you know, being, you know, brought up in the UK and the huge amounts of television, mm-hmm. you know, and the comedy that we got on TVs, and I think it's kind of more osmosis than being sort of intentional. But I think that's the writing that I like to do. And when I'm talking to people who want to be writers, when I'm doing like masterclasses, and I say what you're doing is trying to train yourself to really not think when you're writing. You know, it's got to be intuitive. And it's got to come out without touching the sides in whatever form it comes. So yeah, no, I'm fully on board with what you're saying. But if you're asking me why, I think the answer is no. I don't know. This is my upbringing, and this is what I find amusing, and it seems right. You know, when you want to write something, and you're saying, "Is that going to work?" You know, all these Denver clones. You know, and it just seemed right. So I thought, yeah, go for it.
Yeah, it actually inspired me to read Rebecca because I wanted to figure out what exactly you're trying to get at with that reference.
It's a good read, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great read.
It's not too long either.
It's good.
It's nice and snappy. And then I saw the film and suddenly the film made more sense.
Yeah, and it's a book with a car chase, which I always like. Mm.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Now you just need to attack Gaslight.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Sort of the world, the word of the year.
Yeah.
Now with the Thursday Next series, they're set in 80s Britain.
Yeah.
And you grew up in Wales.
Mm-hmm. Well, sort of Wales, London, Devon, all kind of all over
the
place. Okay,
so just southern Great Britain.
Yeah.
Why that time period?
Well, at the time, I was writing. I started writing it in 1995.
Yep.
And although the book that you start out to write is not the book that you end up with,
mm-hmm.
right? So when I was initially starting to write it, I had the idea that it was a now it can be told story, right? You know, where you'd say, do you remember when, you know, Jane Eyre had a different ending? Mm-hmm. You know, what was that all about? And then you go, well, and then you'd tell this story. So I had this kind of Name of the Rose beginning to the book originally where we have a much, much older Thursday Next explaining this kind of story, and that all went by the by. But I wanted it to be told in sort of retrospection, mm-hmm. and it was an arbitrary 10 years previous to when I was writing the book, which 95 then becomes 85.
Sure.
And it was that simple, really.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's no particular reason why it's set in the 80s. I just did not want it to be contemporary, you know.
Well, I was thinking about it as an outsider from the UK, that it might have been a reaction to Thatcherite Britain and that time period, because, you know, the People's Republic of Wales, or is it the Socialist Republic of Wales?
Socialist Republic of Wales. Yeah.
You've got that, and then almost, I don't think any mention of the royals.
No, I don't think so.
And a more democratic Britain than we see today.
Yeah.
So, with that time of huge economic change, but.
Yeah, and it was kind of a weird one, and I didn't. Sometimes you think, well, and you're right, it's set in Britain. You know, what am I going to use? What am I going to play with? What am I going to? And the royals didn't seem to enter it, and I think that there might be some reference somewhere where they were maybe sent off to Canada at the beginning of the war and got torpedoed, or just liked it and enjoyed it in Newfoundland so much they stayed, or something like that. I think there's some bizarre reference somewhere. But I just sort of left them out of it, really.
Mm.
I don't know why, but I just didn't want to do anything with it. And I don't think they appear in any of the books.
Right.
Yeah. Although dispossessed aristocracy do turn up in Early Riser.
Yes.
Yeah, which I think is really quite funny. I quite like that.
Mm.
We'll now return to our interview with best-selling author Jasper Ford, who sits down with The Informer's executive producer Arian Potts as they discuss his speculative fiction, geek culture, Brexit, the royals, and his career working in film.
Moving toward things that are a little bit more contemporary, your home country is going through a constitutional crisis of extreme measures, and it's challenging for people on all sides. No one seems to have any consensus about what's going on with Brexit. But aside from all of that and the leave and remain stuff, how do you maintain hope when you're faced with a situation that is so No matter what your view on it, I think it's just so overwhelming.
It's a really hard one, and we were talking about this earlier. And I have this, I think in general I'm a sort of optimistic, and I have this sort of saying that, you know, in every car wreck there's always a usable bolt, you know, and out of the car wreck that is Brexit, there must be something that's gonna come out of it that is usable. You know, going forward into whatever this world, this world of extremes that we seem to be entering. And I've noticed, you know, and certainly, you know, I think it's changed me, certainly over the whole Brexit thing, certainly realizing, you know, how much, you know, racism and xenophobia there is in the United Kingdom, and how we were kind of beguiled into this notion that we were in a, you know, modern pluralist society, and we weren't.
Mm.
And I think there's a way in which I think certainly people I know and me are re-examining what it is to be British, you know. And before, you know, even 10 years ago, you know, I think a lot of people thought, well, yes, I think, you know, the average Briton, you know, is generally a good people, 8 foot high, you know, certainly worth at least, you know, two Frenchmen and three Spaniards and all this sort of stuff. And now we're kind of reappraising that, you know, and we're saying, you know, are we the bad guys, you know? And this is very interesting, and this is also coming out of academic. There are now academic papers who are looking at you know, appeasement, looking at the run up in the 30s and all this sort of stuff, and you know, and I don't think we're going to look very good out of it, and I think that is healthy, you know, because it's this reappraising of this notion of the, you know, this sort of arrogant you know, British, and that might be helpful in the long run, but short term it's, you know, it doesn't look good, I must say. I don't know whether you want to talk to the next book I'm doing is my Brexit anger book.
Oh really?
And this is all about it's called The Constant Rabbit, and it's the premise is that 55 years ago 18 rabbits had an anomalous anthropomorphizing event, right? So ordinary rabbits became 6 foot high and could talk, you know, wore tunics, and could drive cars and did all sorts of things that, you know, humans and rabbits did. So this sort of, you know, and writing books about talking, you know, animals is always good fun.
Yeah.
And then and that's what happened. But then the book is set in 2021, where there are 1.2 million rabbits, and a family of them move in next door to in this little village in Middle England. And of course the talk instantly is, well, you know, they breed. So there's this kind of riff on xenophobia, on racism, on fragility, hominid supremacists come into the story. And it's kind of really sort of my take on and complicity, you know, complicity in a racist society. And it's all about that told through the eyes of rabbits. I describe it as Watership Down meets District 9. And my way of looking at it, and I think this is the way, sort of, you know, I'm dealing with it. I should be dealing it better. I should be doing on marches and throwing bottles through windows, but I'm far too polite for that. So, you know, then you become perhaps maybe part of the dialogue. And I kind of think that writers should not be preachy, because that's really boring, and there's always pushback if you're preachy. But there is this sort of, you know, cloud of collective consciousness, you know, that gathers above all of us, and as an author you can just sort of like maybe huff it in the direction, you know, that you want to go, you know, sort of celebration of diversity or, you know, social inclusion, and you just want to push it that way just a tiny bit, you know, but the most you can hope for. You know,
I've got a really left field question for
you. Go on.
So everyone's had dreams about the Queen. Like, everyone has had a dream about the Queen.
Well, in reality, you mean?
Yeah.
I do you know what? I do not think I've ever dreamt about the Queen, I have to confess. But anyway, carry on.
So it's like a thing. It's like the most dreamed about person.
Yeah? Okay.
I've read that somewhere, or I've made it up.
Okay. No, yeah, that's
maybe I made it up in a dream.
Yeah, okay.
But Elizabeth has been such a figurehead of British culture and society, and she's in her mid-90s now. And won't be with us too longer. That's going to represent a huge mental change in people in the UK when she passes, and suddenly we have King Charles and Queen Camilla. Do you have any thoughts about That's...
I don't really have many. I don't have too many thoughts. The royalties, you know, sort of peculiarities of my tribe, perhaps best described, like, you know, like the C of E. I don't know really. I mean, it depends which way it goes. I mean, it's worrying because the nationalism that we have at the moment, this, you know, sort of, you know, almost sort of, you know, British supremacism that we have. And that then there'll be this sort of patriotic outpourings as well, you know, and that I don't think ever ends particularly well. But I did notice on the news this morning that Prince Harry is actually opening his own car door and closing it again, you know, which is a major breach of protocol, apparently. So if he can open his own car door, I mean, this is like it's, you know, we have clearly have nothing to fear, you know. But it's kind of joke, but it's kind of, it's a, the royalty is kind of rather bizarre.
Oh, definitely.
I don't know what's going to happen. Who knows? But it might be a good opportunity for Australia to turn into a republic, couldn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When
another referendum.
Madge goes, yeah.
And it's probably fairly likely. I just don't see King Charles, Queen Camilla.
King Charles doesn't work really, because you just always think of the breed of dog, don't you, when you say King Charles like that. You know, you think of the little starty eyes and the sort of earnest look, and it just doesn't work, does it? Yeah.
And I sort of ask about that because it will be just a big outpouring of emotion and a very unusual time. And I think as someone who's quite perceptive, that it might be a really interesting time to explore. Because we saw what happened with Diana.
Yeah.
And then it'll be a different kind of emotional breakdown at that time. Like, I'm certain that we'll get a day off here in Australia.
Yeah, I must say, do you know, I mean, it's not a subject that ever comes up in conversation in the UK. I must say, it is not, to people I know, it is not on the forefront of our minds. And it's, I suppose, what do I think is going to happen? A huge outpouring of grief, emotion, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, we'll be on to, you know, I'm a Celebrity, get out of here, you know, series 9. So people are easily distracted, and that will be the moment, and then we'll move on, and as one does.
Well, I like to worry and plan ahead. It comes from growing up in earthquake country.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
So I'm always thinking about the next disaster.
Yeah.
And just one more question on this royal topic. So there was a film and a play and a TV film a couple of years ago called King Charles III. And in it, it's when Charles takes over after Elizabeth passes, and he starts a constitutional crisis by he withholds royal assent for a bill that's been passed by Parliament. Uh-huh. And it's about reducing the freedom of speech in the media. So allowing people to sue or to have publications be stopped if they're publishing defamatory content. And it goes against his core values. And it's this whole interplay between Charles and Kate and Camilla and such. And it ends up sparking a full-on constitutional crisis. And he gets under pressure to abdicate to a next generation because he is so unpopular and has to cope with being unpopular.
I like the sound of that.
Yeah, so it was on
I didn't see this.
It was on the BBC a few years ago, and I actually saw a production in Seattle, which was odd to see Americans doing.
Yeah, doing
royals.
Royals. Yeah.
Yeah, but it just, you know, that struck me as kind of similar to what's happening now with the High Court in Scotland.
Yeah. Well, we're in so much in Brexit, we're in so much uncharted territory right now. The precedents are being broken continually.
Yeah.
Because we don't have a constitution that is written down, it's based on precedent. You can break it, and all these things are being broken. And now they're suggesting that, which is a sort of, you know, weaponizing, I suppose, sort of that royalty thing, is that Boris Johnson misled the Queen. If that is the case, if the Supreme Court upholds the Scottish courts on Tuesday, it will be, you know, yes, you've misled the Queen into asking her to prorogue Parliament. So all sorts of things are going on and again, and almost every day there's some new, strange, you know, thing that's going on that we've never heard of before. And half of me thinks, well, you know, this is sort of mammoth shakeup, and there must be some usable bolt in this in this car wreck. And I'll just, you know, hang on to that. You know, hope, I think.
Yep. What are you reading now?
What am I reading? I think I'm reading at the moment. I've been trying to put the Constant Rabbit to bed. But I was reading a book about intelligence in octopuses.
Yeah.
And I read quite a lot of nonfiction, actually. Just because it's very interesting, and I want to know what's going on with, you know, research and things about octopus intelligence is fascinating, because it asks all kind of questions about alien intelligence, because intelligence has evolved twice on this planet. Good intelligence, sound intelligence has evolved twice, because our common ancestor with an octopus was a kind of little nematode of some variety, you know, which was 600 million years ago. So, you know, and you think, well, you know, dogs are clever and horses are clever and dolphins are clever, but, you know, we have quite close relatives. Yeah. So that's quite, and the avian intelligence is another big one, because they're very different separate branch. And that to me is, you know, fascinating. And octopus, you know, what's not to like about octopus intelligence?
Mm.
Yeah.
It's just a pity they have such short lifespans.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a shame. But they're kind of cool, actually. They're kind of cool. I like them.
Do you get a lot of inspiration for your writing from nonfiction?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. There's all kinds of things that pops in, whether it's Neanderthals or dodos or vortex cannons or nuclear piles or anything like that. There's always some. I'm just interested in stuff, and I've always been interested in stuff. You know, whenever I'm sort of wandering around and looking at things, and like I notice that you have a cough button, and all this kind of stuff is really groovy and wonderful, and I love all that input, and all of it can be used at some point, I figure, in books, and I just have this mind a bit like a sort of drift net, and things catch in it, and then I can use them later to have fun with what I'm writing. In Early Riser, there's a nice little subplot about during the winter, humans sleep through this very dark, cold winter. There is a mythology that's built up around the winter and these creatures that live in the winter. And one of them's called the Gronk, who I really like, who feeds on the shame of the unworthy. And this is a mixture of like a sort of Moomin Troll, which was a, you know, Tove Jansson series, which is spectacular and I read when I was a kid. And another part of it is from a comic book I read once. And you take all these little bits from here, there and everywhere and kind of repackage them and change them and merge them and move them. And you end up with something new and exciting. Mm. So, yeah, I just read a lot. I like input.
That was our interview with best-selling author Jasper Ford. This has been The Informer Daily, and we'll be back bringing you LGBTIQA+ news and current affairs around Australia and the world.
The Informer is funded in part by the Community Broadcasting Foundation, cbf.com.au, and of course, the members and donors of Joy 94.9. You can help us by visiting joy.org.au and become a member or donate. Any amount helps us bring you community-powered radio. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.